Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Welcome to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Gateway Marketing Cafe. Gateway brings together the world's finest products with Iowa-grown foods and passionate personalized service. Check out Gateway Marketing Cafe. Thanks also to Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry with 23 years of experience. Joe's been leading the community as an activist for a long time. He's a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. You can contact him at 515-208-7312. Well, I hope you all had a great holiday, Thanksgiving that is, or Truthsgiving, or whatever you prefer to call it. I think it's important to recognize that the earth is good, and if we treat it right, we get a great harvest, and we can enjoy that harvest with our family and friends, as we have done here, and plan to do again for the rest of this month, actually. We have a lot of fun time coming up with family, friends, and neighbors. Hey, a quick shout-out to the Des Moines Irish Session for our bumper music. Thanks, To some of the best Irish music in Iowa for helping to make this program a little more interesting. Speaking of interesting, got a long agenda for you today, folks. Immigration. Going to be sharing some words of wisdom from, well, wait for it, Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush. Also going to be looking at a full-page ad regarding the First Amendment. And related to that, I want to talk about an Irish language ban that I think is relevant to today's world. We'll also be looking at Venezuela and disturbing stuff that might happen there. Got some numbers for you regarding poverty that I think are interesting and play right into something I want to talk about. And that is the realistic strategy you need to be aware of and consider when approaching any kind of nonviolent resistance to authoritarianism. I think there's been some good information out there recently I want to share with you. I also, if we have time, I also want to talk about a couple things relevant to Iowa. The fact that we are the only state in the country with a growing cancer rate, and that we are the second highest overall in terms of the amount of cancer per capita. Also want to talk about data centers. Let me start off with President Trump's response to the horrible murder of two National Guard troops in Washington, D.C. And again, you know, all of our hearts go out to the families of those who were killed. But what Donald Trump is doing to kind of weaponize that tragedy is, well, predictable. Very well, I think, encapsulated by a recent column by Robert Reich, who points out that Trump's response has been disproportionate and bigoted. He vows to, quote, permanently pause migration from all third world countries. And so, what is a third world country anymore? It's always been a negative, you know, tag. Does it mean anything anymore? I mean, I don't know what he means by that. He also says he intends to deport legal immigrants born in countries that the White House considers, quote, high risk. Well, that's pretty arbitrary. Trump is also threatening to strip U.S. citizenship from naturalized migrants, quote, who undermine domestic tranquility. Again, very arbitrary. And my favorite is this, my favorite meaning the most disturbing. Trump says he will deport foreigners deemed to be, quote, non-compatible with Western civilization. Well, so maybe I'm in trouble for having this Irish music thing going on here, eh? I don't know what he means by Western civilization either, but I'm sure, well, it may not include Ireland, but it certainly doesn't include anywhere else in the world, Asia, Africa, South America. I mean, This is unhinged, absolutely unhinged. You know, and basically, in short, Trump wants to use this tragedy, to ramp up his anti-immigrant policy, which is already horrible. But let's put this in perspective. You know, right now the GOP, certainly elected officials for the most part. Well, that's starting to change, more on that. Elected officials and the base are falling behind him when it comes to this immigration, rampage. But, you know, it wasn't always that way. And I want to share with you a clip from April 4th of 1980. It was a debate between George Bush and Ronald Reagan. They were running for president. There's a third person in this clip as well, but I don't know who that is. I can't recognize that person, and they aren't introduced. So I'll just go with the what we hear from these two, George Herbert Walker Bush and Ronald Reagan on immigration. And again, to be clear, if they said this today, they would be booed out of a GOP convention.
Yes, my name is David Grossberg, and I'd like to know, do you think the children of illegal aliens should be allowed to attend Texas public schools free, or do you think that their parents should pay for their education?
Who are you addressing that to?
I think you're first in this.
He was looking right at you.
I said he was. Look, I'd like to see something done about the illegal alien problem that would be so sensitive and so understanding about labor needs and human needs that that problem wouldn't come up. But today, if those people are here, I would reluctantly say I think they would get whatever it is that they're, what the society is giving to their neighbors. But the problem has to be solved. The problem has to be solved because as we have kind of made illegal some kinds of labor that I'd like to see legal, we're doing two things. We're creating a whole society of really honorable, decent, family-loving people that are in violation of the law, and secondly, we're exacerbating relations with Mexico. The answer to your question is much more fundamental than whether they attend Houston schools, it seems to me. I don't want to see a whole, if they're living here, I don't want to see a whole thing of 6 and 8 year old kids being made, one totally uneducated and made to feel that they're living with outside the law. Let's address ourselves to the fundamentals. These are good people, strong people. Part of my family is a Mexican.
Can I add to that? I think the time has come that the United States and our neighbors, particularly our neighbor to the south, should have a better understanding and a better relationship than we've ever had. And I think that we haven't been sensitive enough to our size and our power. They have a problem of 40 to 50% unemployment. Now, this cannot continue without the possibility arising with regard to that other country that we talked about, of Cuba and what it is stirring up, of the possibility of trouble below the border, and we could have a very hostile and strange neighbor on our border. Rather than making them, or talking about putting up a fence, why don't we work out some recognition of our mutual problems, make it possible for them to come here legally with a work permit, and then while they're working and earning here, they pay taxes here. And when they want to go back, they can go back, and they can cross and open the border both ways by understanding their problems. This is the only safety valve right now they have with that unemployment that probably keeps the lid from blowing off down there. And I think we could have a fine relationship, and it would solve the problem you mentioned also.
Wow. Open the border. Ronald Reagan. Okay, so again, that speech would be booed out of most GOP conventions these days. Agree with all of it or not, it's a world removed from what we currently have coming out of the White House and the approach to immigration espoused by Stephen Miller and Tom Holman and President Trump. Now, I do want to say this. It's important to recognize and remember that Ronald Reagan's policies in Central America, especially in Nicaragua, Grenada, Panama, El Salvador, his policies were horrible. I mean, tens of thousands of people died because of them. And those policies were illegal. I mean, yeah, they were illegal. Let's admit that. You know, Grenada, when Reagan invaded Grenada in 1983, by a vote of 108-9, the UN condemned that invasion. The UN also condemned the U.S. invasion of Panama in 1989. It condemned the U.S. military action in Nicaragua, also in El Salvador, where 75,000 El Salvadorans were killed by death squads supported by the Reagan administration. So, yeah, I have no love for Ronald Reagan's foreign policy, but I point out this speech or this answer to a question on immigration because it is so different than what we see today. So, again, you know, the resistance is building. We talked about Marjorie Taylor Greene, but I want to share resistance from another angle that came to my attention this past week. That was a full-page ad in the Des Moines Register. I understand the ad also appeared in the Omaha World Herald. It may have appeared elsewhere in newspapers around the country, perhaps especially in the Midwest, I'm not sure. But the ad was labeled The New War on Dissent, Sedition, Silence, and the Assault on Democracy. And it's by a guy named Brent Lambie, who I don't know. So apparently he's, I looked him up, he's a guy from Colorado. He must have a little bit of money because these ads are not cheap. The ad challenges President Trump's use of the Sedition Act, which dates back to 1798 and was actually expired in 1801. And the ad reads, quote, "Even in the early Republic, leaders knew it wouldn't survive. The Sedition Act wouldn't survive constitutional scrutiny. Modern First Amendment doctrine makes it unmistakably clear resurrecting the Sedition Act or even invoking its spirit against political opponents, comedians, journalists, or members of Congress is completely baseless, profoundly unconstitutional, and fundamentally incompatible with American democracy." End quote from the ad. So the ad, you know, it addresses the video in particular that was published by six Democratic members of Congress who had served in the U.S. military or the CIA. The ad reminded service members of their duty to not obey illegal, unconstitutional orders. And that is the law. You're not supposed to obey illegal, unconstitutional orders. The ad also says, quote, "The intimidation of Stephen Colbert, Jimmy Kimmel, newspapers and television networks, often through veiled threats of politically motivated mergers or regulatory retaliation, represents a direct attack on the First Amendment's guarantee of a free press." Yeah, that's Brent Lambie in this full-page ad. And he concludes by saying, "I write this editorial with the full understanding that people raising valid legal or constitutional concerns may fear retaliation. That fear is itself proof of how urgently this conversation is needed." He goes on to challenge us to document everything, share concerns with trusted people. If you ever feel threatened, contact appropriate authorities and civil rights organizations. Your right to speak freely is protected by law, no matter who attempts to intimidate or silence you. Democracy requires that citizens refuse to bow to fear. And the First Amendment is not just a right, it's the cornerstone of the American promise. What can I say? Kudos. Thank you for doing that. So I want to tie in the Irish language ban, which dates back to the 1300s. It was when it prevented English colonists in Ireland from speaking Irish to the Irish. Yet they had to use English. They had to force the Irish who were being colonized to hear whatever it is they wanted to be ordered to do in English. That, of course, got a lot worse in the 17th and 18th centuries under the penal laws. Lots of things happened then. And one of them was you couldn't speak Irish. You couldn't play Irish music, which, I mean, it's amazing that Irish music survived. It's amazing that the language survived. So, and then later that mid 1800s, all school systems were required to teach everything in English, and any teaching or speaking in Irish was to be punished. In fact, there were some people put to death for speaking Irish. So, I bring this up because it took some courage to fight back against this injustice. And again, this went on for centuries. And believe me, the Irish music continued to be played in Ireland during the penal laws, during the the colonization by Britain, during the occupation by Britain. You know, so yeah, we're in a bit of a fight here against our right to speak. Just the Irish have, you know, their right to speak in Irish was being denied. Our right to speak is being challenged, and we need to be brave. We need to be persistent. We need to support each other. We need to speak out. And, you know, I like Lee Camp. You ought to check out Lee Camp. He's a comedian and social commentator who I think sometimes he goes further than most people are going to want to hear, but he usually has really good information and some really good one-liners as well. He quoted extensively recently from an Oxfam report that in the past year, the 10 richest U.S. billionaires gained nearly $700 billion in net worth. He points out that if you made $60,000 a year after taxes, in order to make $700 billion, you would need to work for nearly 12 million years. That's a long time to work. Lee also pointed out that the richest 1% own half the stock market, 49.9%, while the bottom half owns 1.1% of the stock market. And for the record, I own 0.0% of the stock market. So Donald Trump is the first billionaire president. The rich now are richer than they've ever been, even richer than during the Gilded Age. And of course, the Gilded Age, that didn't lead to a bloody revolution, but it did lead to significant, a kind of a legislative revolution that brought about the New Deal. And so, you know, we're at that time now. Poverty is like, you know, the gap between the rich and the poor is like it never has been. We see an erosion of our rights. We see criminal activity on behalf of the administration. And it's going to happen. We're either going to have a revolution that involves weapons and violence, or we're going to have a revolution of reform. We're going to see law changes that address some of these systemic, deep-rooted problems that have been with us a while and have been only getting worse. Ed Fallon with you, folks. Back in a minute on the Fallon Forum.
Thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our sponsors, including Catholic Peace Ministry. CPM promotes peaceful resolution to war and the need to end the permanent war economy. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com. Thanks also to Westrom Optometry. Dr. Joel Westrom and his staff are fluent in English and Spanish. The clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry. All right, I'm going to pick up where I left off, and that is with what I think is maybe not good news, but at least really, really good information. It's an article by Jamila Rakib. I think I'm saying the name right. It's entitled The Playbook of Every Successful Nonviolent Struggle. And we are at that point where this stuff needs to be taken very seriously. The author points out that nonviolent movements have been toppled, have toppled oppressive regimes, prevented coups, and transformed societies follow these four essential steps. And the first one of those steps is understanding the issue, understanding the problem. Too often, we are inclined to take a knee-jerk position on something. We've seen this before. I think we saw it with the whole defund the police movement. And that was a much more nuanced conversation that a lot of people weren't ready to have. The article points out movements often jump into action without a clear picture of the terrain they're navigating. We must resist the impulse to respond to every outrage with immediate mobilization. Instead, we should pause to assess the situation. Now, this is very consistent with Gandhi's approach to dealing with social conflict, with injustice. And his method is really spelled out well. A book I highly recommend to you if you're interested in strategy is The Conquest of Violence by Joan Bondurant. She examined Gandhi's various campaigns in great detail and laid out, I think, about 9 steps that you go through. And actually, this is very consistent. The first one was, hey, understand what's going on. Don't just assume things. Don't assume that, quote, your side is always right. You know, look into the detail before you make a move. Now, the second point in this article is build power. And the author gives plenty of examples. Sudan's neighborhood committees, which emerged in the 2019 resistance and helped bring down Omar al-Bashir's regime. They were decentralized grassroots. They coordinated protests, disseminated information, and organized mutual aid. Again, very important. And they basically created parallel centers of power grounded in local legitimacy and trust. And of course, we see right now Sudan is in a horrible situation. That does not negate the value of what those decentralized structures were able to accomplish. The author also points out Lithuania during the final years of Soviet domination, how Lithuanians built alternative communication networks. Again, the Valinform. We try to be part of that. Small audience of, you know, thousands. But more and more of that should be happening. It's important, you know. The Lithuanian resistance also coordinated economic resistance to the Soviet regime. They prepared people for civilian-based nonviolent defense. And then looking in a different continent, in Africa, you know, in South Africa, the anti-apartheid movement formed street committees and people's courts. They played a crucial role in resisting apartheid and building new forms of democratic participation. So the author gives a bunch of other examples and points out that in the U.S., there are structures in place that already could kind of form this kind of local decentralized network of resistance. Faith groups, garden clubs, tenants' unions, and unions generally, I guess, neighborhood organizations. I mean, these are all little pockets of people power that can, with appropriate involvement, be mobilized to provide some resistance to authoritarianism. The third item in this strategy is marches and rallies. No, they are not the, and I like this because I'm you know, everybody loves a good march, a good rally, very empowering. I mean, heck, I'm the long march king, right? This is what I do. I march all over the place, and those can be very, very valuable, very helpful. But they're also only symbolic unless they are part of a broader strategy to change the power dynamic. And basically, that involves withdrawing cooperation from illegitimate authorities by, you know, applying economic pressure. You know, for example, why would anybody shop at a chain or support Amazon or any of these big corporations that are draining local economies draining, you know, killing local businesses in order to enrich the billionaires who, as we talked about earlier, the 10 top billionaires in the U.S. saw their net worth increase by $700 billion last year. So, you know, we need to think of rallies and marches and that sort of thing, protests and civil disobedience. That always has to be part of a strategy that is beyond, you know, beyond the symbolic gesture. It has to be, okay, how do we actually put a hole in the armor of the beast that is threatening to, you know, to control us completely? So, you know, and fourth, the final point they make in this article, defend our wins to ensure long-term resilience. It's important. You know, you can, I mean, and we saw this happen in Serbia. We've talked about Serbia before on this program, how when Milosevic was overthrown, it was a great moment. And and then things were let to slide. And as a result, now Serbia finds itself in a similar predicament. And that's really important. You've got to be prepared to back up the immediate euphoric victory with policy changes, with, you know, with a campaign for how that success can be maintained and defended, and you know, what do you do to keep it going forward in the right direction and to avoid letting things slide back. So the author gives a whole bunch of other examples from around the world. It's a good article, folks. It's called The Playbook of Every Successful Nonviolent Struggle by Jamila Raqib. And I think we need this now in our country probably more than we ever have. And so, looking at Venezuela, and before we talk about Venezuela, I'm gonna go off on a little bit of a tangent. I want to talk about our work as beekeepers. We have a wax moth problem, and I know this is not the sort of thing that keeps most people awake at night, but we have a wax moth problem. We have a couple hundred frames. Those are the panels on which bees raise their young and store their honey, store their pollen, store their nectar. And when wax moths get in there, I mean, if the hive is active, yeah, the bees will take care of those wax moths. But if the frames are sitting empty, as they often are, the wax moths will get in there and destroy the entire foundation. That's like letting your house run down and then having to rebuild it in the spring. It's a horrible waste of time and effort on behalf of the bees. So what we do, what I'm trying to do right now is freeze all the frames that may have had wax moth damage. And pretty much I'm freezing all of them, a couple hundred of them. So, but as I was doing this today, this morning, I found a spider in there. And I just squashed that spider. And I found another one and another one. I squashed all three of them. And then afterwards I felt bad. Maybe not many people feel bad about squashing a spider, because I thought, I really don't know that spider's story. I don't know if that spider was friend or foe. Maybe that spider was eating wax moth larvae. I don't know. I just took action before I had any idea what I was doing, and I regret that. I'm going to try to learn what that spider is when I see one again, and behave more accordingly, considering what its function is relevant to our beehives. I might go ahead and squish it anyhow, is what I'm saying. But chances are, maybe it's doing something good, or maybe it's neutral. And what does this have to do with Venezuela? You're asking right now, shaking your head, Ed, where are you going with this? Okay, so we've seen the indiscriminate blowing up of boats in the Caribbean Sea, and this is much, much more important and impactful than me and a few spiders. But my point is, we have no idea what's happening on those boats. We have no idea whether there are actually drugs. And I think the logical conclusion is, if there were drugs, the U.S. military would be intercepting those boats, going, aha, look what we found, and then taking appropriate action. I mean, it certainly has the capacity to do that. There is no logical reason why they should be blowing up these boats without knowing what's on them. And again, you know, I mean, chances are they might find that, oh, these are just fishermen. oh, these are just people, I don't, who knows what. Or maybe they will find drugs. But the, if they really thought they were going to find drugs, they wouldn't be doing it this way. And especially noteworthy is the boat demolition that occurred, I think, on September 2nd, where they bombed it. It was reported that there were still survivors. And what did they do? They bombed it again. That is horrific. That is absolutely horrific. And now Pete Hegseth is coming under criticism for this. The human rights director for the UN, Volker Turk, has urged Washington to investigate the strike's legality, saying there's strong evidence they constituted extrajudicial killings. Republican Senator Roger Wicker of Mississippi, he's the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and he announced an investigation into Pete Hegseth's possible war crimes. Of course, Trump stands by Hegseth, but that's pretty significant. Again, Marjorie Taylor Greene exiting Congress, resigning next month, after a series of, you know, criticisms of President Trump on Gaza, on the Epstein files, on the government shutdown, and finally being, you know, having death threats. She finally said it. She's had enough. She doesn't want to put up with this anymore. She's getting out. And I never thought I'd say, God darn, I'm sorry to see Marjorie Taylor Greene go, but I was, but still am. But I will say that I think that she has started. She's the camel's nose that has poked out from inside the tent and said, hey, maybe something stinks in here. And now others are having the same reservations, including Senator Wicker. Also, Rand Paul. So, you know, we are seeing more and more Republicans questioning the leader, the authoritarian, the dictator, unhappy with the way things are going. And I think this situation in Venezuela, no pun intended, but I think it's about to blow up in terms of the Republican Party. A lot of people who supported Trump did so because they're non-interventionists. They want, quote, America first. They don't want regime change. And, I'm going to play you something, folks. Speaking of regime change, you may know that Tulsi Gabbard, of course, was a very strong opponent of regime change, and specifically in Venezuela. Here's what she said.
The United States has a disastrous history of military intervention and regime change around the world, which has brought suffering to millions of people, it's bankrupted our country, dishonored our troops, and it's undermined our national security. We must end this policy now before we get into yet another military conflict, this time in Venezuela. Now, President Trump and his administration have already instituted heavy sanctions on Venezuela. They've doubled down on their position that all options are on the table. I wholeheartedly support the Venezuelan people as they fight for a free and fair democracy. But the United States should not be in the business of intervening, of picking who should lead their country, and we certainly should not be threatening military action. Venezuela poses no threat to the United States. Congress has not authorized the United States to go to war in Venezuela, and there's no justification for our country to violate the sovereignty of the Venezuelan people. Now, the reality is that threats of U.S. military action and regime change in Venezuela is undermining ongoing efforts to convince North Korea to give up their nuclear weapons program, which exists because Kim Jong-un sees it as the only deterrent against U.S.-led regime change. Now, President Trump is promising North Korea, we will not wage regime change war against them, but at the same time is simultaneously threatening regime change in Venezuela. North Korea is going to look at President Trump's actions, not at empty promises. The United States needs to stay out of Venezuela and let the Venezuelan people determine their own future.
Okay, that's Tulsi Gabbard on Venezuela. Of course, that's Tulsi Gabbard during the first Trump administration. I mean, every one of her words there makes sense today, but she's not saying it now. Maybe she will. Maybe she will join the, as of now, small but growing bandwagon of Trump allies who are saying, you know, you are wrong. And we've seen what happens to Trump allies who did that in the first, you know, Trump go-around. But, you know, if Tulsi Gabbard has any integrity left, any self-respect, any consistency, she will bail out on the Trump administration and stand by what she said years ago when she opposed regime change war in Venezuela. Ed Fallon with you, folks. Back in a minute with more conversation on the Fallon Forum.
Catholic Peace Ministry is an independent nonprofit guided by an ecumenical board representing many faith traditions. Founded in 1980, Catholic Peace Ministry focuses on nuclear disarmament and ending the wars between Israel and Hamas and Russia and Ukraine. CPM's overarching concern is the need to end the permanent war economy, which must be challenged if we are to achieve lasting peace and justice. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com.
At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village. Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to Story County Veterinary Clinic, where Dr. Kim Holding has been caring for all creatures, great and small, for over 30 years. Learn more at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Thanks also to Architecture by Synthesis. Owner Mark Clipsham asked that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. All right, welcome back. Folks, I want to say one more thing about the blowing up of boats and killing of people in the Gulf. There was, I believe this was a New York Times story, referencing a city called Santa Marta in Colombia. It's a port city on the Caribbean. And a reporter from the New York Times went there to meet a family of a fisherman who Colombia says was killed by one of the U.S. military strikes, one of the 21 boats that were blown up. Again, 83 people on those boats have been killed. And the U.S. Navy says they're targeting the smuggling of drugs. Although, as we have discovered, there is not a lot of... Venezuela is not a hotbed for drug activity. Here comes Trump pardoning the former president of Honduras, who has been convicted of his role in working the drug cartel and getting rich off of it, trafficking in cocaine specifically. You know, so if Donald Trump was really concerned about the drug problem, he'd probably send the guard here to Iowa and crack down on anhydrous, which is used to make meth. I mean, I'm not saying that's a great idea. But so many other things make more sense than what Trump is trying to do in Venezuela. So back to this port city of Santa Marta, the fellow named Alejandro Carranza. He was 42 years old. He was a fisherman. And he had an easygoing personality, described as an easygoing personality, enjoyed drinking beer and playing pool. Colombia's president said at a news conference last month that Carranza may have been involved very intermittently with drugs, adding that many fishermen along the country's coast dip into the drug trade because their poverty level leaves them with few alternatives. The president said that, but his wife, the mother of three of his kids, told the reporter that he had never smuggled drugs. If he was some kind of narco-terrorist, then why are we living in misery instead of a mansion? So, you know, the bottom line again is that if we really wanted to know who we were intercepting, troops would have boarded the boats, discovered the drugs, taken all the photos, had all the evidence. So, you know, I don't know. It's impossible to know for sure, right? Because it's all, everything's been destroyed. Anyway. Well, I want to switch gears to Iowa. Back to Iowa here. This is a conversation that may impact people all over the country too, but let's talk about cancer. And related to that, I first want to talk about land ownership. There's a report out of the University of Illinois that reminds us that, quote, Iowa has one of the strictest laws on land ownership. It bans foreign governments or investors from owning agricultural land in Iowa, with some exceptions, including if it was bought before 1980, is no more than 320 acres, or is being used for research or non-farming purposes, end quote. In other words, there's a lot of loopholes, even in Iowa's strong anti-foreign ownership of land law. And other states, I mean, there's all kinds of opportunities for a foreign company, or Bill Gates for that matter, to come in and buy as much land as they want. Here there are restrictions, but there are ways around some of those restrictions. And one of those restrictions allows a foreign corporation to buy a chunk of farmland for a factory that is involved in some kind of industrial enterprise. And we've seen that happening years ago with an Egyptian fertilizer company. We also have Smithland, biggest hog processor in the U.S., owned by China. Syngenta, big seed company, also owned by China. A few years ago, Monsanto tried to buy off a bunch of Iowa politicians. Between 2002 and 2018, they dropped almost $500,000 into state legislative campaigns. And earlier this year, this last legislative session, state senators in Iowa put forward a bill that would have limited civil liability associated with pesticide use. It was called the Cancer Gag Order by opponents. And of course, that bill had a lot of support from big companies like Bayer. Now, again, Iowa is the only state in the country with a growing cancer rate. And I know every time one of us says that, speaks that truth, the chambers of commerce around the state grimace because they know that people are going to say, whoa, why do I want to move to Iowa? Only state with a growing cancer rate and the second highest cancer rate in the country. It's bad. It's bad. And we should be able to figure out why. I mean, there's probably a lot of reasons, but there are some clear, probable culprits, and pesticides is certainly one of them. Pesticide exposure here, especially in the rural areas, is very high. That relevant to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, leukemia, breast cancer, prostate cancer. You know, the efforts by the big chemical companies, and when I say chemical companies, I mean chemical/seed companies. It's horrible that those two enterprises are now combined. But, it's no doubt that pesticides are a big part of our growing cancer problem here. And, look at all the lawsuits. I mean, Bayer did an $11 billion payout for Roundup-related cancer claims. As of last fall, October of 2024, Bayer had settled nearly 100,000 lawsuits. 100,000 lawsuits linked to glyphosate. A lot of these from farmers. And there are another 54,000 lawsuits still pending. And they settle these and they don't go well for the company. You know, it's very obvious that there is a link between their product and cancer. You know, Roundup is just one of these chemicals. It'll be interesting to see how hard in an upcoming election year, the chemical companies want to push this legislation to provide them immunity. Clearly, they are losing a lot of cases, and clearly, they're losing a lot of money. But the what's true about this is these chemicals are problematic. Again, we are Iowa's the biggest agricultural state in the country by some measurements, and the only state with a growing rate of cancer, the second highest cancer rate in the country. You know, and I would say it's also probably the nitrates in the water. I mean, we have the largest nitrate removal system in the world here in Des Moines. And that has to be there because of all the nitrates from chemicals getting into the water system upstream. And, you know, trying to, you know, there are farmers doing the right thing. And I think more farmers would do the right thing if there were, you know, was some help there, was some incentive. And again, if the incentives were shifted, right now we have a, and this is a whole other conversation, but we have a whole approach to the farm economy that's not, it's working great for Cargill and ADM and the big corporations that are in the middle that make all the profit. You know, farmers often operate at a loss. Consumers, we see prices going up. Yeah, but in the meantime, the folks in the middle and the big agribusiness companies that make the chemicals and the seeds are making a heck of a lot of money. You got to be making a heck of a lot of money to get 154,000 lawsuits, pay them off, and still make a profit. One other thing I want to talk about is with regards, not just Iowa, but this is relevant to other places around the country, data centers. I mean, Iowa has given at least $150 million in tax credits each year over the recent years to support data center development. A new Iowa law caps the state's business development tax incentives to $110 million. That's down from $170 million last year. It's still a heck of a lot of money, especially, you know, these things are hideous to look at, by the way. I mean, people complain about wind turbines. I can see how you might not think that's an attractive thing to see on a hillside or out in the ocean beyond your beach. But there's nothing beautiful at all about a data center. And when you get all big clusters of these monsters, they look terrible. But that's the tip of the iceberg. I mean, they're using so much water. And I wondered about, what goes into that water? And does the water just get recycled back out again? Well, apparently there's a lot of stuff going into that water. Because you have to add chemicals to it to prevent corrosion, to prevent scaling, to prevent biological growth. Some of these chemicals include corrosive inhibitors like phosphates, molybdates. I'm not even sure what that means. Borates and azoles. I don't even know what any of those are. But they also include biocides and algicides, antifreeze agents. Propylene glycol, I do know what that is. Ethylene, I know what that is too. But, and I don't know if these are closed loop systems or what. At some point, what happens? I don't know whether the water gets discharged back out into the environment. There are descalers. There are flocculants used during construction to bind the soil and prevent erosion into local water systems. So the use of these chemicals, along with the high concentration of minerals that occurs during evaporative cooling, means the resulting blowdown or wastewater is often contaminated and requires proper management to avoid environmental harm if discharged. Yeah. So again, I think there's a lot of questions about what happens to that water. And again, it's a huge amount of water, millions of gallons a day, for all these data centers that are surrounding our communities. And not just that, but energy. The energy consumption of data centers is so big. It's huge. It's beyond anything we've seen for any other industry. And the way it's going right now, it's estimated that the data centers could account for more than 14% of the U.S. total power demand by 2030, triple the amount that it does now. You know, I mean, it's a huge problem. And of course, Donald Trump, his vision is to make it easier for these data centers to be built. Well, there's a guy in Wisconsin who I love his humor. A guy named Charlie Behrens. It's a great video, but the audio is pretty compelling as well. Here's Charlie on pretending to want to become a billionaire through AI and data center construction.
We want to become trillionaires.
Yes.
That means we need to steal the people's data
so AI can take their jobs.
Yeah, but we don't call them the people. We call them the product.
Right.
And we don't say steal. We say
terms and conditions.
Yes. Here's what we need. Perfect. We're going to need a massive, loud, power-sucking building. Bigger.
But we do not want this close to us.
No, that would be terrible.
But where are we going to put them?
We're going to put them in small towns.
The people will never go for that.
But the politicians will. They'll just tell the people they're creating jobs.
But AI is eliminating jobs.
Not construction jobs.
Eventually, AI is going to eliminate those too.
By that time, they'll have already built the thing that kills the jobs. It's too late.
It's too late.
It's too late.
It's too late.
Yeah, we're going to be rich. Oh, wait.
What?
We're going to need a ton of water. Hundreds of millions of gallons of water.
But we'll tell the product that it's not a lot of water.
That's going to work.
It has.
They're gonna find out.
I got this. We'll tell them it's closed loop technology.
How often do you have to change the water?
I don't even know.
Are you putting in the water? Are you putting PFAS in that water? They last forever. It's poison.
Shut your mouth. We're just gonna tell them it's a trade secret. No more questions.
It's a trade secret.
It's a trade. You don't have to know.
They don't have to know.
They don't
it's
have
a
to
trade
know.
Secret, it's you sons of. How dare you ask me what I'm putting in your water?
You scared me right there.
If anyone still wants to complain, we'll just say you use email, you use social media, you use a data center. Even though an AI data center is completely different because you use a ton of power.
Wait, how many gigawatts?
I don't know, 1, 2, 3 gigawatts.
That feels like a lot.
Hey, it should feel like a lot because it is a lot. But we need it. We need it.
We need it.
Because there's no way for us to advertise you with all the data we steal from you if you don't give us the gigawatts.
Listen to the man.
How are we going to get that approved?
That's a good question because we'll need power lines and that'll steal a bunch of land from people through eminent domain.
Right. You're like, you can't live here. You can't live here.
Oh, I know. The utility. They'll make billions making us new gas plants. We'll just let their lobbyists do the lying for us.
But the product wants renewables.
Yeah, tell them it's 70% renewable.
But do we put that in the contract?
Do we put that in the contract? No, we didn't put that in the contract. Are you crazy? We can't actually do it. We're just going to say it.
What about all the people who live around there?
Are you talking about the poor farmers and the working class across the country?
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean.
Mm. I can't help it. They're not rich. That's their fault.
They'll call flyover states for a reason.
The defense rests, Your Honor.
Is it a land grab?
Yeah.
Could their power bills go up and there be rolling blackouts?
Yes.
But you know what? Mass surveillance isn't free.
Yeah.
I bet these politicians are so dumb they'll give us tax breaks.
Yes.
Tax breaks now, bailouts later.
Genius.
Yes.
The town is never going to vote for that.
The town doesn't have to. The common council will.
We only need to convince a few people, not the whole town. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Okay, but what about when people show up to these council meetings?
Nobody's going to show up to the common council meetings. No one's ever going to find out.
I know. I'm proud of us.
Have you been filming this whole thing?
Yeah.
Son of a...
Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design build services for high-performance, low-maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Hey, thanks to our partners, including psychiatrist Dr. David Drake. If you live in Iowa, Dr. Drake can help with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. Contact David Drake, FamilyPsychiatry.com. Hey, Kathy, welcome to the program. It's time for our farm and food segment. And, of course, the first week of the month, it's always our garden Q&A. And, yes, December garden Q&A. There are still questions out there.
Because
we have answers.
Well, because it never stops. It's a year-round thing.
We never stop eating, so we never stop doing things with food.
How dare we?
So here's a question. I thought this was an interesting one. What varieties of sweet cherries grow best in north central Iowa? What do you know about sweet cherries?
Well, they're asking about Zone 5A, and just for reference, the USDA hardiness zones are referenced from the warmest places are Zone 1, and then the coldest places are Zone 13. So we are... we're in the middle, and...
But I've only seen sour cherries here in Iowa. Have I missed something?
There are now some sweet cherries in Iowa, right. And that is because... Oh, did I say 1 is the coldest and 13 is the highest? I think I said it backwards. I need to correct myself. The reason is that the hardiness zones are changing because we are in a zone more like northern Missouri now. In these past 20 years or so. So that is changing. So sweet cherries do grow, and certain types. Some things you want to remember is that sweet cherries blossom earlier than the sour cherries. Therefore, they are more susceptible to the late spring frosts. Okay. And in Iowa, the Iowa State University Extension suggests the varietals Gold, Black Gold, and White Gold. And in that's in the southern two-thirds of Iowa. In southeastern Iowa, they recommend Hedelfingen. I'm not sure. Kristen, Sam, and Van. Now, I'm not familiar with any of these. You can go online and learn what those are like.
But bottom line is, I mean, you won't be planting them till April or May probably. But
you want to be very
careful.
Maybe
now's a good time to start planting because sometimes these things can sell out.
And check for cross-pollination needs. They have very different cross-pollination needs.
Another question. Who's starting seeds for next year?
We are soon.
Well, December's a little bit early, but not for artichokes. We'll do artichokes probably this week, but everything else, January, huh?
And we save our own seed from our artichokes. And there are some people who are starting now looking at this Facebook group, and they have hoop houses or greenhouses or even just those big plastic milk jugs or something, and they're starting some things in their say in their garages with some lights and things like that.
So someone asks, we rent and the landlord is considering letting us build a couple of garden beds on top of the grass in the backyard. We would not be able to dig into the yard.
They were asking for some advice about composting in that post, but basically the comment that we would have on that is that both the landlord and the tenant should be aware that if you put a raised bed on top of the grass and put your soil in on top of that, it's no different than digging into that grass for a better harvest overall. It depends on how deep a root you're going to be planting. If it's a long root crop like a tomato or a pepper, you're going to need to dig that grass. So it doesn't work like that.
It depends if you're going to have a foot tall. I mean, some people have 6-inch tall beds. Ours are a foot tall. Mm-hmm. Although I'm intrigued by going 2 feet tall for certain crops. But bottom line is. You're going to destroy the grass anyhow.
So I do appreciate that landlord is open to the idea of people growing food in the space. We need to see more of that. And you and I, Ed, as Birds and Bees Urban Farm, have been working with the city to try to get more people interested in that.
So if somebody says, I'd like to try growing sweet potatoes next spring, I'd love to hear from anyone who has successfully done this in our climate. I'm in southeast Iowa.
We had a good sweet potato harvest this year.
Yeah.
Let's start with the making our own slips, growing our own slips with last year's sweet potato.
Yeah, we found a few good ones from a neighboring farm, nearby farm, and then we didn't do any, just stuck them in water.
Halfway down,
with the toothpicks. You have to try to figure out which is the up end and the down end. And that you can look up. We're not going to go into that in the time that we have left here. Yeah, but
it's hard to do, actually. We had to flip one around at one
did.
Point.
Yeah. We did. We misjudged it. It's kind of hard
to have to start them early. I mean, I'd say start them in January.
Start them in January because they take a while. And then people were interested in how to get their slips. That's the little starter plant that you use to plant. And then what do you do after you harvest them? And our curing process worked stellar this year.
Yeah. We devote an entire downstairs bathroom. It becomes our sweet potato sauna.
It's got a heater and a humidifier. And it's a small bathroom, by the way.
So you need 85 degrees and 80% humidity or 80
something like that.
And for 10 days. So that's a room that's entirely committed to sweet potatoes for a while.
Well, we had sweet potatoes for lunch, and you made a sweet potato pie for Thanksgiving. Yeah. So we're in sweet potato heaven.
Yeah. Hey, thanks to our production team of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Dedeman, Charles Goldman, and Kathy Burns. This is Ed Fallon thanking you for joining our program and thanking our local small business partners, Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Westrum Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, Architecture by Synthesis, and real estate agent Joe Henry. Thanks also to our nonprofit partners, Catholic Peace Ministry, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Old Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. And finally, thanks to the Des Moines Irish Session for providing our bumper music. We'll be back next week with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio.